Ian Curtis singing singing or actually playing the great soul serenade. This just somehow sprung right into my mind, and I guess that is a fine enough conclusion for tonight's edition of Earthwatch. And thank you all for being so brave and bright and helping advance the discussion. See you next week. Send me an email, rknight, R-K-N-I-G-H-T at WBAI.org. Stay tuned for Hour of the Wolf coming up with Jim Frey after this. Come on.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a Wednesday night, Thursday morning program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. If you want to put all of those together, well, then you'll want to hear Gay Partington Terry. Stay tuned.
Well, from lonely to us. I rode the dog all night. I hear the big sigh as I close my sad eyes. I didn't think it was wrong. I didn't think it was wrong. I didn't think it was wrong.
And you are tuned to listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio in New York City, WBAI, broadcasting at 99.5 My name is Jim Freund. This is Hour of the Wolf. Let us first get announcements out of the way. The first Tuesday of every month would be next Tuesday, July 3rd. And so people are saying, Jim hasn't announced what the next reading at the New York Review of Science Fiction is going to be. Well, I will. It's going to be in 3 months. It'll be in September. We are doing something we hadn't done for a while. We're taking a summer vacation. We used to do this all the time. We used to have actual seasons. We used to actually run from September through either May or June and then just take time off and retool. And 2 years ago, we stopped doing that because here would come July, and all of a sudden a publicist would call me up and say, I got some guy coming into town named Paolo Bacigalupi or something like that. It's not anything you'd be interested in. It's like, the hell I wouldn't. So it's Paolo's fault because of Paolo Bacigalupi. We teamed him up with Saladin Ahmed, and that was a pretty darn good reading. And then there was a reason to do one the following month. I think that was John Joseph Adams' fault. He had a new anthology out. And then a similar kind of thing happened last year. And all of a sudden, people assume that we go 12 months a year. No. We're doing 10 months this year. Also, there was a possibility that the venue that we're in, the Soho Gallery for Digital Art, may be undergoing some renovation, so we wouldn't have the space available, in which case I was going to rush to put readings together. But no, that's not going to happen now. So I'm going to sit back, relax. We will start in September, but we're not going to start with the first Tuesday in September. We'll start with the second so that we move away from the World Science Fiction Convention and move away from Labor Day weekend. So please take no note of the date other than we plan to see you then. That will be September 11th. And one of our two readers will be Richard Bowes. I do not yet know. I have not yet arranged who the second one will be, although I know I'm going to see this person at ReaderCon. If it isn't the person I think I'm going to see, it'll be somebody else I see at ReaderCon, because everybody's at ReaderCon. Many people are at ReaderCon. Many people are at BEA, the Books Expo of America. I guess it was Booksellers Expo of America. And I was a booth babe for this year's BEA. I was working with James Gates, who actually that very same day was on this show. It was the day after Ray Bradbury died, but we only found out that very day. At the beginning of this month. And the Science Fiction Writers of America had a booth there, and they were doing signings. And a person with whom, well, she had been in touch with me, and I was undutiful and had not gotten back to her, was Gay Partington Terry, who has a new collection of short stories out from Nonstop Press. I'm proud of myself. I didn't even look at the book to know that. Luis Ortiz, take note. I did my homework, darn it. And Nonstop Press is a very cool small press with high literary and artistic value. They publish, among other people, the wonderful, magical Carol M. Schwiller. And who else? Gay, do you remember offhand who else they publish?
There are a couple of other collections. I know Barry Malzberg is in one.
Oh, that's the other person going along with
Rick. I can't think of anymore.
Who I'm going to see at ReaderCon. It's Malzberg. It's Malzberg. Oh. And Barry, I know you're probably listening now because he's everywhere.
Uh-oh.
Every time I make a major misstatement about something in the history of science fiction, particularly if it involves something Barry was involved in, like the Scott Meredith Literary Agency, I hear from him. He saves them up, and he sees me, and he says, oh, hi, Jim. Okay, yes, you made a mistake on this date and that date and all that. Anyhow, Nonstop Press has turned out some really good stuff. They're what I used to call small press, but I've been told by some small press people like Jacob Wiseman and all that, that independent press is now probably a better phrase.
Politically correct?
Or politically collect as well. At WBAI, we politically collect. We find everything that's, you know, left and we collect it. And as our past program director said, the only left left. I like that catchphrase, I have to say.
It is nice.
Anyhow, Gay Terry, who I was referred to through Carol M. Schwiller, and also, you were at her 90th birthday, weren't you?
I was,
at the Soho Gallery for Digital Art.
Yes.
I shouldn't do this, but I was pleased with myself for that, that we were able to pull that off and have cakes that she could eat.
She is a pretty fantastic person. She really is.
She really is. I knew her husband, not well. But in olden days at WBAI, we would show movies and stuff in our studio C, our old, we used to be located in a church that we owned. And we had movie festivals, and we actually had an Ed M. Schwiller movie festival in Studio C. And I knew his artwork, of course, from all the magazines, much of which Carol had been the model for.
Yeah.
And, by the way, Carol, but...
It's a very big honor to know her and to be in the writing group with her and be friends with her. It's really great.
Yeah, she's a remarkable person. Yes. Having said that, now I'm feeling terribly guilty because you may remember that I borrowed an Ed M. Schwiller painting of Carol that is, in fact, the cover of a Nonstop Press book, The Collected Stories of Carol M. Schwiller, Volume 1. And I still have that painting. I need to get it back to her. It's been over a year. I need to get that back to her. The two times I was going to, it was pouring rain. You know, and then
that's a likely excuse.
It was a real excuse. I'm scared to have that thing. I consider it a treasure.
It is.
I'm scared to have that thing in my care, but I'm taking excellent care of it, but I need to get that to her. Carol will now be 91 because April 19th has come and gone already.
Yes.
And, but you have been busy. What is a writing group like? What is your, okay, before I get to that question, we heard a nifty piece of music after the intro for the show. Tell me what that was.
That was a song that I wrote the words for. My husband plays the piano, and he wrote the music with the help of David Bennett Cohen, who is one of the founding members of Country Joe and the Fish,
a
famous 60s band, and a good friend of ours. And we wrote a few songs, put a few on a CD, and Bobby Day sings it. There's some good... David put the band together with friends of his, and my husband plays a little of the piano. David plays a lot of the piano and the guitar.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just sort of for friends and family.
It's fun. It's got a great sound to it.
Thank you.
Yeah. I really like it. I worked with Country Joe briefly. I was, God help me, business partners with a gentleman by the name of Abby Hoffman.
Oh.
And we had a company together called Radio Free America, and we put together a benefit, co-benefit for WBAI and, well, sort of for Abby himself, but for Radio Free America. And we had Country Joe McDonald and whoever he cared to bring along. I don't know. I don't remember the names of who he brought along, but I certainly worked with Country Joe for that event. So,
well,
so that was a thrill for me. But I'm digressing. What's it like being in a writer's group with Carol M. Schwiller? What do, I like to tell this to listeners, because we have had writers groups en masse on the air on this program. Altered Fluid is a writer's group that has N.K. Jemisin and Matt Kressel and Alaya Dawn Johnson and, well, it's got about Saladin Ahmed. It's got about 12 people in it. And we've had them all in this room where one of them will read a short story and then the other 11 will critique it.
Oh, brother.
Live on the air. Live on the air. This is my version of reality show. It's scary.
Yes, very.
But every writer's group is very different. There's another writer's group called Tabula Rasa, which has Richard Bowes in it and Barbara Krasnoff and Robert J. Howe and Andrea Kail and a few other people. And they work totally different. So, does your writer's group have a name?
No, I don't think it does.
There's another one with the unlikely name of Circle in the Hair.
Oh, wow.
Or no, CITH.
We didn't name ourselves. It's a very mixed group. It's not all science fiction fantasy writers. There are poets, a couple of poets, and literary short story writers, and Carol and me. There's a Hindu nun that writes.
I've met her.
Yes?
She's a very impressive woman, I
yes,
must say.
Yes, she is. Yeah. And so it's a very mixed group of all different things. And I guess it works like every writer's group. We read our stories and we criticize and help each other out and encourage each other when we get depressed and all of that sort of
thing. Is it all short stories?
No, there's poets, and there's,
I should have said, is it all shorter work?
Because there's a woman who's writing a volume 2 of a novel, novelized version of her life, and she's Romanian, and she survived Hitler and Stalin.
Wow.
So it's an amazing novel, and she remembers everything.
Yeah. Yeah, you don't forget like that. My parents were German Jews, so they're not around now, but they could tell you.
Yeah, she's had an amazing life.
Yeah, but both Hitler and Stalin, that's frying pan into the fire.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. So, yeah, it's my parents were lucky. One of them got out to here, and the other one got to where else? Casablanca.
Oh, very nice.
Yeah, Casablanca. Not really. Bogey wasn't there. And from Casablanca to Marrakesh, she actually spent more time in Marrakesh, but walked from Prague to France, got on a boat, went to Casablanca, went to Marrakesh, and then 3 years went by before she was able to get to the U.S.
Wow.
Long story, wonderful story, horrifying story, wonderful and horrifying at the same time. I don't want to get bogged down, but I know that listeners are often fascinated in the process of writers' groups. And there is, I think a lot of people who are listening, especially in the middle of the night, are writers or wannabe writers. And I know that whenever I've done shows talking about the process and of putting together fiction, It always gets a good response from the listeners. So I aim questions that way.
I can't tell you much more. It's not unusual to do that sort of thing. Just, you know, read and have help and have encouragement. It's...
Mm-hmm.
I need more encouragement. I need a lot of encouragement, actually.
Uh-huh. Does the group get critical? You know,
yes.
Like, yeah, okay. Yeah. So it's not always... yes, it's encouragement, even
well,
the
I'm
critical ones.
Well, I'm also a big girl. Right. I can take criticism.
Okay. That's good. That's good. I have seen... I'm not going to tell... Not going to name names. I have seen big boys and girls who are like, "You didn't get it!"
Yes. Oh, yeah.
You know, so when nine people didn't get it simultaneously, you have to wonder.
Yeah.
So
I've been in groups like that.
Yeah. How long have you been writing?
Well, I've been writing off and on since I was a kid. I periodically give it up to do things like raise my children. And sometimes just I get sort of frustrated by it and do things like perfect my pie crust kind of things.
Ooh.
Or get a job once in a while.
But I'm working one of those two right now. I've got my pie crust down.
Really?
That's yeah. Great. Well, I cheat. I buy frozen pie crusts.
Well,
the filling, though, I make from scratch.
Well, that's
everything that goes inside I make from scratch. I'm not a baker. I'm a cook.
I can't improve on my mother's pie crust, and she uses, you know, Crisco, so it's not exactly healthy.
Oh, I just gained weight when you said that.
Yeah.
I take it back. I have done graham cracker pie crusts on my own, but there's nothing to that. You just, you know, squash it. Find an L. Ron Hubbard book. Or something you really don't want to read again. That'll take care of the I shouldn't say again. That'll take care of pressing it down. But when did you start publishing your fiction?
I think other than, you know, school newspapers and things like that, the first publication was Twilight Zone magazine.
Ooh, okay.
And that story is actually in here, Grasping the Bird's Tail, and it's based on, I've been doing Tai Chi for 35 years,
mm-hmm.
And the title comes from Tai Chi. It's kind of a Tai Chi magician, Tai Chi master, or who's a magician in a China that never was, only in my head.
The editor of Twilight Zone magazine was, escaping me. Yeah. I mean, that was an actually darned good magazine. It's, for listeners who don't know, wouldn't know, this is all post-Rod Serling. He had already shuffled off at that point, and Carol Serling was overseeing the thing. But Twilight Zone magazine was its own entity. And they were very good. They were a large-sized,
yes,
slick magazine.
Yeah.
In, I guess, the 80s, mostly?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. They were very, they had a very high literary standard, I thought.
Oh, good. Glad to hear you say that.
Yeah, no, I remember well. And except I'm not, I'm going to have to, while you're reading, which will come shortly, I'm going to have to look up who the editor of that magazine was, because I really admired
it. I can't think of it either.
Oh, this is awful.
Yeah, I know, it's bad.
Well, on the other hand, it's 30 years.
Yeah, it is. It's a long time.
Yeah.
And I don't have a good memory. That's why I make things up as I go along, because I've never had a good memory. I can't even blame it on age.
I have a good memory for the most useless information.
You have a wonderful memory.
Yeah, so ask me again who the editor was. I'm the one who brought it up anyway. But I just remember it had a very good editor who I think went on. Well, I'll look it up.
Okay.
Why science fiction?
I don't know that it is science fiction. One thing that everybody has always told me is that I don't fit into any category. I had a hard time getting published in the beginning because I don't seem to really see things like other people. They've always told me that. But that is why people like my stories, I think. That and rampant imagination, which comes with I don't have a firm grasp of reality.
Yeah.
So
I should say, by the way, that I constantly use the word science fiction for almost everything. It's all one big genre out there, and I'm always getting into pedantic fights with people about how, yes, Dune is in the same genre of literature as Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
As is Borges, as is Thomas Pynchon.
Well, if that's true, then I guess I fit into a category. That's great.
Yeah,
that's
it's just that category doesn't really have a good name.
No.
But whatever that name is, that's what this show is about.
Okay.
And I frequently had people on the show who've read stories that, well, they're not fantastic or absurdist or anything at all. They're just good fiction. And it's, I had somebody call up and complain, saying, I wasn't science fiction. I said, did you like it? Well, yeah, but click. I hung up and said, okay, you liked it. Go away. We have fulfilled our mission goal. But I do like to think that stories of the imagination that take, you know, one step, oh God, did I almost say one step beyond, one step further than the normal, I don't want to use the word mundane, great fiction that isn't SF, isn't mundane. I always like the Heinlein term, which is speculative fiction.
Oh, that's a good word.
It's a very good word. And people think that it sounds all new and mushy and all that, but it's actually a term coined by Heinlein in the 40s in Astounding. And I think that says it allows you to throw a lasso over a very wide imaginative branch.
Okay, I'll take that.
Yeah. So, having said that, I guess another way to ask the same question rather than why science fiction or whatever is, what was it that you were reading that was sparking your imagination to write the way you do?
Well, I don't have a firm grasp of reality at all, apparently. People have always told me that, and I just...
That's probably a good thing, given what reality is like.
Yes, it's a little scary, reality.
Yeah, I would say.
Yeah. So, and I don't have a great memory, so I make things up as I go along, and I don't know, I just see things differently, I guess. That's what I've always been told.
Well, should we? Oh, look at that. It's just a little after 2, and I should do a station break and just say WBAI New York. Why don't we get a taste?
Okay.
Of the irreality. Is that a word? Irreality?
Maybe.
Well,
you could make words up.
Okay, good.
Fine.
I just did.
I've made a lot of words up myself.
Actually. Yeah, but you're a writer.
I'm going to read The Holy Sisters of Shadir. Each tiny stitch the Holy Sisters embroider bears a prayer. They are committed to a lifetime of devotion through the eye of a needle. A baby blanket might have millions of stitches, enough prayers to protect a child through puberty. A house banner with a similar amount of stitches protects a family from certain categories of pestilence and infringement by lesser demonic creatures. But it's a rare person that could hope to obtain such a valuable piece. A lucky woman might acquire a mantilla to cover her hair or wrap around her throat for refuge. It was more common for both men and women to obtain socks, stitched with prayers for mobility, stability, and steadfastness. But few peasants could afford even these treasures. They were fortunate if they could procure a wee pouch in which to keep a lucky coin. The price of these needlework masterpieces was not only gold and gems, but good deeds, high ideals, modest sentiments, and temperance. Of course, there were always worthy people who fell into dire circumstances that compelled them to relinquish a precious prayer piece in charity, and an unknown number of these treasures fell into lesser hands by fraudulent means. Sometimes the prayer stitches worked to save the illicit beneficiaries from their base affectations and better their lives. Others, the more vulgar or evil recipients, often had strong physical reactions to the objects, and if they were not discarded, the torment they produced incited them to new and more fervent acts of maliciousness and vice. For it is known that people cannot be protected from their own malevolent natures if they're not willing to participate in the process of benevolence. On the morning of the seventh day of the sixth lunar month of the 1018th year of the Era of Sand, the 16th Holy Mother called the sisters together. "We've been offered a formidable commission," she told them. "The new High Chancellor asked us to create a work to cover his royal divan, the seat of power." Astonished whispering swept through the room. The 16th Holy Mother waited for it to stop. "As you can imagine, the High Chancellor is not our ideal patron, but I sense a vein of possibility in him, albeit overlaid by frustration and disappointment. I'll want volunteers to prepare a ritual supper for us tonight." She sighed. "The Chancellor believes we fast on such occasions." The sisters chuckled. "I'll collect the dream threads in the morning. That will be all for now." The sisters ate their fine meal of sweet rice, leaves of the feathered palm steeped in exotic herbs, curry sea lily, juju figs and cream, and cardamom taffy. They all slept soundly, except for one novice, who joined the order after her lover was killed in battle. Sister Glory Grace tossed and turned, sweating beads of grief as she did every night. In the morning, she laid her bedding on the low bushes outside her window in the hope that wind would blow the night's remorse out of them. She'd done this every morning for 15 months. She purified herself and her belongings often, humbled herself with hard work, sat in meditation, and chanted ritual prayers endlessly. But she still heard the sound of his boots on the stones of the old hallway at night, felt his hand on her shoulder at vespers, and caught the scent of him on her pillow, even though this was the 18th new pillow she'd acquired. When she went before the 16th Holy Mother to receive her assigned task for the day, the Holy Mother told her everyone must work on the High Chancellor's commission at least for part of the day. "Please, Mother, I don't feel I'm proficient or virtuous enough to work on such a project." "Nonsense. I've seen your samplers. Your stitches are as tiny and uniform as Sister Violace. It's time you involve yourself in a communal project." The Holy Mother put her arm about the girl in a tender gesture. "It'll do you good, dear." So Glory Grace joined the other sisters in the sunroom to work on the piece for the High Chancellor. The sun was so bright as to be nearly blinding, the better to see every tiny stitch. The sisters were busy untangling the dream threads and winding them on spools when Glory Grace added her meager thread to the cachet. Because the sun was so bright, no one noticed the slight discolor of her dream fiber, and it was wound on a spool set for the embroidered clouds, along with pearly grays, alabasters, whites, and silvers. No one noticed the slightly grizzled tone of her thin strands. This alone, however, would not have had a formidable effect on the design, except to temper the light it emitted and moderate its effect slightly. What did alter the work's intention was an incident that occurred on the 15th month and fourth day of work in the last hours of peak afternoon sun. The sisters were intent on their work when a peasant woman who was carrying pea beans for the sisters' supper was stung by a bode wasp. Father Acilius, who was taking a meditative walk in the garden on the other side of the nunnery in order to mentally prepare for evening prayer, was the first to reach her. The cry of agony he emitted when he found her dead was indescribable, for he'd seen her fall and was there in seconds, unable to offer nostrum or solace. Perhaps Sister Glory Grace was aware that the agonized cry had precipitated thoughts of her dead lover. Perhaps she even realized that she'd dropped a stitch, but the sight of the poor village girl, ashen and shriveled, her pupils snapped in agony, the sight of the sting on her ankle, black and swollen, emitting a rank odor and oily discharge, drove out all rational thinking. The sisters spread bane needles about the grounds to kill off the bode wasp, for where there's one bode wasp, there's always a mate. They washed and wrapped the poor village girl and called her family for burial. Afterward, they were in such a state of emotional exhaustion, no one noticed the drop stitch. 6 days later, after the funeral and after the bodies of the two bode wasps had been collected and burned, the sisters partook of cleansing rituals and went back to work on the chancellor's project with pure hearts, unaware of the drop stitch. The divan cover took another 12 years to complete, which was amazingly swift for such a project, as the larger and more complex pieces often took a lifetime to finish. But all other projects had been put on hold, and every sister and novice worked long hours, deferring all but the most necessary tasks for survival. Sister Glory Grace found her calling with the Chancellor's project. She worked tirelessly and perfected her stitches until they were the finest, most even points of subtle prayer. She wore out hundreds of needles and dispelled her grief with the prick of each stitch. The 16th Holy Mother had chosen a design that mirrored the enchanted realm of the great mother of all, the magnificent Kingdom of Deep. The nuns' delicate stitches would depict an ornate landscape bursting with pristine streams, exotic flowers, fantastical trees dripping with chili berries, and the enchanted creatures that serve the mother. Thousands of details set to invoke the perfection of a higher world. It was a task so awesome that it couldn't be contemplated as a whole. Each small unit was its own ideal, worked on as a separate entity, refined to a precise archetype. Sister Glory Grace's assignment was to make the small knots and spiraling stitches that depict the flowers of the sacred gem fruit. When they finished the project, the nunnery was in ruins, the once lush gardens a tangle of dead vegetation and weeds. The roof leaked, the plumbing had failed, and mice overran the empty larder. The nuns, especially the older ones, were decrepit. Many had become delirious in the last year of frantic work. But the aging 16th Holy Mother was certain that with the commission they made from the Chancellor, they would be able to restore the nunnery and its gardens to its former quiet elegance and nurse the nuns back to health and spiritual well-being. The High Chancellor was informed, and royal upholsterers set to finish the divan. A great unveiling to be held in the castle's rotunda was announced, and the nuns assembled on the appointed day. The nuns had had very little contact with the world for the last 14 years, So they were astonished at the change in the countryside on the way to the palace grounds. Farmlands had declined, and streams were choked and filthy. Smoke from factories wafted through the air, and mountains were scarred and collapsed. The people, however, were better dressed, and many were plump, a sure sign of abundance. In contrast to the sisters' dull, disheveled appearance, the palace was a splendor, reflected a hundredfold in pools surrounding it and the mirrored ceilings of the interior. Some of the nuns were embarrassed at their ragged habits, but the 16th Holy Mother told them, "It's no matter. We are aesthetics, not court figures." The 16th Holy Mother was still vigorous and had become more animated in her eagerness to collect the appalling sum promised them and reestablish their peaceful, pious life. But she was visibly shaken by the overly warm anterooms, choked with a cloying mix of perfumes, an annoying murmur of derisive whispers, and the rustle of silk taffeta. "Stay close, my dears," she said. "We are in a house of impure spirits." Sister Glory Grace was especially appalled by the vast expanse of the town cemetery and the pile of unclaimed bones at the west gate. Lord Ashbury called for quiet, and the High Chancellor addressed the company. The 16th Holy Mother accepted payment and thanked him for the commission. Father Acilius delivered a brief blessing over the divan, and the retinue passed by to marvel at the fine needlework, brilliant colors, and intricate design of the cover, as well as the delicate carving of the spalted bloodwood frame. Then the High Chancellor sat, heavy with authority. He rested his elbows on the padded armrest. He leaned back and the crowd applauded. Attendants brought trays of cream fruit and mandrake wine. Musicians played and costume dancers swirled through the room. No one noticed the High Chancellor's fists curl. When the 16th Holy Mother came before the Chancellor to repeat her gratitude and take her leave, she observed that the light of fulfillment had gone from his eyes, but she didn't say anything. The rest passed by one by one. Only Sister Glory Grace recognized the aspect of regret and realized he was encountering his lost moments, sinking. Later that night, as the lights flickered dreamily and the lavish company chattered, the High Chancellor fell through the drop stitch. Perhaps he landed in the Kingdom of Deep, in the presence of the Mother of All, though this is doubtful, as he did not possess the exemplar qualities necessary for access to that place. Perhaps he still hovers between that world and this. Perhaps he resides in some other realm, or in the darkness of oblivion. No one knows, and it's of little consequence to all but him. With his disappearance, the position of High Chancellor went to his son, a quiet, peaceful boy. But before all his treaties were in place, he fell through the drop stitch and disappeared forever. The office passed to his brother, well-meaning but dull-witted, then to a cousin more interested in the arts than the welfare of his people, the brother of that cousin who was untutored and insane. All disappeared mysteriously by way of the divan. Three more distant cousins fled rather than accept the position, and an unscrupulous merchant who bought the office sat on his own throne but was killed by a mob. Power was seized by an evil dictator who decreed himself divine. He divested the kingdom of all things beautiful and frivolous. The divan was placed on a bonfire along with elegant and coveted objects from all corners of the kingdom. The holy sisters of Shadir were nearly thrown on the fire also, had it not been for the pleading of the crowd and the promise that they would give all their assets to the state, remain isolated in their nunnery, and never work their needles again. This was agreed. But the sisters stitched prayers of hope and justice in secret, And after many years, a hero arose and set about overthrowing the dictator. Then came an era of violence that lasted only months, but seemed to last a very long time, as all such eras seem. The season of death and destruction brought memories crashing back to Sister Glory Grace, memories of her lost love, of the 16th Holy Mother, Sister Violace, the High Chancellor's kind son, and others long gone. Sister Glory Grace was an old woman, but she had a nagging sensation of guilt. She'd spent her whole life doing needlework. It was all she knew. So she commenced stitching a mantle of guilt. Some of the other sisters joined in, and when word of it spread, men and women from all over came to add to it. Soon the mantle of guilt was so heavy it couldn't be moved, and many citizens believed they could do whatever they pleased, stitch their guilt into the mantle and be rid of it. Lines of people formed at the entrance of the nunnery. The kingdom was in turmoil, and many small animals and children were lost and suffocated by the heavy cloak. It had to be stopped. On the morning of the first day of the ninth lunar month of the 188th year, the 19th Holy Mother turned the line of pilgrims away and called for men with pack animals. It took 31 sturdy oxen and 47 good men to drag the mantle of guilt out to a field where it could be burnt. Smoke spread across the kingdom and blanketed the sun for 6 days, bringing with it dreams of tragedy and turmoil, betrayal and regret. No one was exempt. 19th Holy Mother announced that from that day forward, no disparaging emotions would be stitched into any of their projects. Should such emotions arise, the sisters were to report to the groundskeeper for heavy labor until these sentiments were sweated out into the soil where they might act as fertilizer. The grounds of the nunnery were transformed to gardens pristine and elaborate. The sisters grew strong and healthy. Their needlework reached a level of perfection greater than the world had ever seen. The citizens resumed responsibility for their own actions, and the kingdom prospered in peace and harmony for 1,000 years, though such eras seem all too short. We can only imagine what happened after that 1,000 years. As we know, alas, such perfection isn't meant to last. Sooner or later, a stitch is dropped, a tear is shed, a whisper of contempt seeps into the waft of even the finest material. Should you come upon a sample of the work of the Holy Sisters, which is unlikely in our world, but who is to say impossible, pass it on quickly if you think there is any possibility you might harbor a secret neighbor that would pervert it, for it could have a ruinous effect on your life. Take it as a sign that you might become worthy of it one day. Covet your good fortune and say a prayer for the soul of Sister Glory Grace and the talented hands of the Holy Sisters of Shadir.
All the Sisters of Mercy, they are not departed or gone. They were
You are listening to The Sisters of Shadir, read for you by the author, Gay Terry, from her collection, Meeting the Dog Girls. This is WBAI, New York.
Baby.
Judy Collins with a Leonard Cohen song, Sisters of Mercy. I love that song.
It's a great song.
It really is. Collins was one of my first, I just loved her early material. Not that her later material and current material isn't good.
And not that Leonard Cohen isn't great.
Yeah, but... but just comparing her early work when she was doing... early Leonard Cohen and Hey, That's No Way to Say Goodbye and all the and Sisters of Mercy and all those songs. That was sort of a sweet spot of great composers with a great stylist, and that was an example. And before that, as mentioned, we heard The Sisters of Shadir, read for you by Gay Terry. The author, and that is a bizarre, wonderful, sick little, everything that you can get into. Sick isn't quite the right word, but, surrealist, and surrealist can certainly be viewed that way. I was mentioning...
That's about as close to a reality as I get, actually.
That's good.
In my stories.
That's good. I mean, for me, it's so evocative. It stretches one's mind to new places, which is what I think this literature, whatever you care to call it, is supposed to do.
I hope so.
Yeah, I was mentioning off the air that what it reminded me of, not in terms of exactly, style or anything like that. But I got the same feeling. I've read the story to myself, but hearing it aloud is a different experience. And it's sort of like stretch the same muscles as when I read an R.A. Lafferty story.
Well, that's great. Thank you. I really appreciate that.
Yeah. And I wish more people knew Lafferty. And I don't know what to tell listeners because I don't think any of R.A. Lafferty is currently in print.
I think you can get it on your Kindle or your iPad. You can get some stories.
You think there are ebooks of him?
I think, yes. Yeah. I think I have one on my iPad.
Yeah. Yvonne has to look for individual stories, no doubt.
Yeah.
And oh, by the way, for the record, I did look it up, and Tappan King.
Oh, that's right.
Tappan Wright King.
Where is he now?
He is apparently living in Tucson.
Oh.
With... I didn't realize, with Beth Meacham, who was an editor at Tor Books. And when I was the stock boy at the science fiction shop here in Greenwich Village, she was the cashier.
Oh, wow.
So that's where he is. He's living with the cashier of the science fiction shop. Never mind the fact that she's one of the best editors out there and worked for years with Tor Books and... all that, that's, what he's doing. He's out there, and And looking at his Wikipedia entry, they say that he was best known for editing Twilight Zone magazine. And while on one hand that's too bad because that was 30 years ago, on the other hand, I thought he did a damned good job.
And well, he did me right, that's for sure.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and a lot of people. He had his own ear. He did not try to emulate it was a problem, I dare say, taking over a magazine that bore the name The Twilight Zone. That meant that, oh, you're going to have to do stories that are like The Twilight Zone. The TV series was on the air again at that point, being edited by a gentleman who's gone into obscurity, George R. R. Martin, I think his name is.
Oh, God.
He was the editor of the TV show at that time.
Wow.
That's right. For those who remember, it was after that that Beauty and the Beast came around. And yeah, George is one of those overnight sensations who's been working for 50 years.
You're like an encyclopedia, Jim. I can't believe it.
I liked what George did to the Twilight Zone. Ellison, I think, Harlan Ellison, was involved in the series first, and he brought George Martin in. But I know these people, so, you know, it's not like I know you. I'm proud of that. You know, that's why we are here. Haven't
Ooh,
seen.
What all do you know about me? That's a little scary.
Well, when one reads this book, is it fair to say one knows a little bit about your family?
Yes, maybe.
Yeah, so. Maybe. Okay, I just threw a curve at you there.
Yes, you did.
But that is sort of. Do you care? Would you like to talk about it?
About my family.
And how it, well, about how your fiction relates to your family, yeah.
Well, my dad was a magician. He had a day job, but magic was his life. And although a magic act, a stage act, and even sleight of hand is a very technical thing, it still brings the possibility of magic into your life. And it's magical that they can even do that sort of thing. And we went to magic conventions, and we had strange people in the house. And wherever we went, we went to magic shops and talked to stranger people.
Yeah, I you and I talked on the phone a little bit about that, because I used to hang out in two magic shops in New York. Al Flosso's.
Oh, yeah.
Lou Tannen's was the famous one, but there was also Al Flosso.
Yeah,
F-L-O-S-S-O. Oh, my God. Well,
my dad used to go and hang out and have lunch with the guys and stand behind the counter and demonstrate tricks.
I have little doubt then that I probably met your father.
You may have. Red Partington.
That it's quite possible. It's quite possible, because I would have been, you know, cutting school or something. I would have been, you know, very young teenager. And to me, there was nothing cooler than to go to either Al Flosso's or Lou Tannen's and find these people that were actually in burlesque or vaudeville. And there was nothing that they wanted to do more than talk to young people.
Yes. Pass it on.
And pass it on. The one person who I recognized and knew from television or whatever was Carl Ballantyne.
Oh, yeah.
Who was, who I knew from the TV series McHale's Navy.
Oh, my goodness.
Which, you know, I was of the age, it was the 60s, and I watched that show. But he was Ballantyne the Great, and he was, his bit, his routine was that he would get it all wrong.
Oh, I remember him, yes.
Yeah, and he was brilliant, because he would do something like, you know, pull something out of a hat and not quite getting it right, and then he would do something and put his arm, and it was an open table.
Mm-hmm.
And we have established, he'd gotten rid of the mirror. It was part of the routine that there's a mirror and that he looks at himself in it and he combs his hair and then he gets rid of the mirror. We now are very clear there's no mirror in there. And he tries to reach into the hat. He can't pull anything out. So he puts his arm all the way down into the hat. And we do not see the arm come out the other side. It is established. There is nothing there, and he's acting like a doofus and all that. And then he gets his hand caught in a mouse trap, and he pulls it out, and there's the mouse trap on the end. How? What? We clearly saw that there was no way this could happen, but it was a brilliant act.
Magic is a wonderful thing, and it's a shame these people who are telling the secrets. You know, I feel really
bad. Yeah, how about that?
I don't like it.
I don't like it either.
And the magicians
it takes
don't
all the
like it. It's
magic out of it.
Yes, it does. You're not supposed to know that stuff.
Yeah, the first time
it ruins it.
Yeah. I mean, in some cases, Penn and Teller, they did a good job with the cups and balls. The classic old John Scarnay. See, I know this stuff.
Yeah,
the John Scarnay cups and balls. And they, in there, before they went Vegas, when they were still doing like the West Side Arts Theater and spaces like that, which is where I saw them, they would do the real thing. And then they did it showing how they did it. Now, this was something.
But
you know
like
what?
That.
They did it so well that it was still good. But that was the only thing they ever showed.
Yeah?
Yeah, that was the only thing they ever did the reveal for. And it was so cleverly done. And they did it so beautifully that it was art. That's the only thing they ever showed. They never showed the stop the bullet trick. They never. And now they're all Vegas.
Yeah.
You have to go to Vegas.
They're all big illusions. My dad really liked sleight of hand.
Yeah.
Best. And going to like a restaurant and going table to table and doing card tricks and coins and things like that.
Yeah. I could never
do it. Takes a lot of practice.
It's quite the skill. I have tried.
Yeah.
I belong to the IMPS, the Independent Magical Performer Society, which met at the Fulton Fish Market before the South Street Seaport was there. And it stank. I don't mean the performers stank. I mean, it was the Fulton Fish Market. It stank. But we would meet there, and I would watch. I couldn't do sleight of hand. As everybody on the radio watching knows, I have very small hands. And I just couldn't do the sleight of hand. I did gimmicks.
Uh-huh.
I was pretty darn good with an appearing cane. I know how to use flash paper with the best of them.
Oh, yeah. I used flash paper in a reading once.
Ooh.
Well, there was a lot of young people, and I was, I'm sort of a gray, older woman, and I wanted them to listen, so I set the place on fire.
Uh-huh, as it were. Yeah, that's wonderful. So, I mean, to me, that's a wonderful thing because I know the universe that you're talking about, the universe of seeing all these wonderful magicians and knowing that your father was one of them. Where did he perform? What kind of venues?
Well, we lived in a small town, so he did do, when I was really young.
In the Appalachians, was that?
Yeah.
You see, I'm psychic. Okay.
Right over the West Virginia border. We did live in Pittsburgh for a while, and he performed in places there. He liked to, towards the end, he only did little restaurants and things, but he did a stage act up until I was in high school because they put me in the act because I was very shy and they thought if I could go on stage it would bring me out. But a magic act is very well practiced. You even practice what to do when things go wrong, so it's not like talking to one person, so it didn't help much.
You're doing okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
I've grown up a little.
Okay, so did that all led a certain amount of surrealism?
I guess so, yeah.
Yeah.
It got me out of the small town atmosphere, because we did go to magic conventions.
And, yeah, and I've never been to one of
meet
those.
Meet strange people. And so we did, it did get me out of that small town.
Ever meet
thing.
Blackstone Jr. or any of those big names?
I probably did, but I was such a little kid that I don't remember a lot. The people that I do remember were very small town, you know, strange people.
Mm-hmm.
And we went to magic stores in places like Baltimore and, you know, crazy places.
Yeah, that's so wonderful. But for some reason, I used to go to Vegas all the time for computer trade shows. And when I started going there 15, 20 years ago, there were, for no particular reason, no magic shows whatsoever. And now there is not the hotel in Las Vegas that doesn't have a magic shop.
Oh, well, that's good.
And doesn't it's good on the one hand that the shops are there and stuff like that. And it's bad because it's all centralized. So what do you do? Go to a different magic show every single night? And they're not, these aren't quaint little things. These are, you know, $80.
Extravaganzas.
These are extravaganzas. These are $80 ticket shows. Maybe in some lounges, they'll, you know, somebody will come up and, you know, pull a coin out of your ear or something. But it's not the same as that wonderful feeling of the small town, the, if you will, the Ray Bradbury sense of the carnival and magic.
Yeah.
But that sense, that's not a bad feeling. The story that you read has that Americana kind of feel to it, not dissimilar to Bradbury, and I can sort of see the connection. So how else does your family figure into your fiction?
Well, there are characters based on some members of my family. Actually, my next book is going to be a sort of novelized version of my life, illustrated with old family photos.
Ooh.
And so there's a lot of family in it. It's called Remains or Dead Relatives Real and Imagined. I have to polish it up a little, but it will come out eventually.
Oh, very good. Do you have a publisher for it? Is it also going to be nonstop?
Or? Yeah.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah.
Very good. Did you say Appalachians or Appalachians?
You're supposed to say Appalachians.
Appalachians. You see. Yeah. Okay, so it's a third thing altogether. Because I always, you know, I knew that Copeland wrote Appalachian Spring.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and then I saw a documentary that said, well, they say Appalachian. Now you've got a
Appalachian.
Appalachian. Okay, yeah. Good. So we reduced it by a syllable.
Yes, by a syllable.
Indeed. This is WBAI. The program is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. With me is Gay Terry. That's the name on the book, Meeting the Dog Girls, which is a collection of short stories. But you also use Gay Partington, Terry.
Yes.
As well for...
Just the Gay Terry looked better on the cover. There wasn't quite room for the whole thing.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, but I like
the Partingtons. I want to keep them around.
Yeah.
They came from a small little island called the Isle of Man.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
You know where that is?
I do, as a matter of fact.
Of course, he knows everything.
No, well, I play music from all different places, so.
Yes, a family of miners, coal miners who died young. And
oh, my God. Yeah.
I just had a letter from a...
Now, I don't know exactly. Is it Welsh specifically?
No, it's Manx.
It's Manx.
It's its own country. It was never...
Oh,
a,
my God.
It did belong to the Vikings for a couple of hundred years. That's the only people that...
Well, yeah, they were just the... They were so imperialistic.
They'd grab anything that they could get a hold of for a while.
Yeah, I had a letter from a relative recently who was doing a genealogy, and he sent a genealogy that goes back to 1690. And there are, and I gave it to my, and there are a lot, most of them are minors, and they died young. You'd think they'd learn their lesson. But I gave it to my son, and he said, the ones that came to America in the mid-1800s went to California and Colorado, so they were, it was the gold rush. So, I don't know. I never knew any of these people, actually, because my father didn't keep in touch, really. My grandmother didn't really keep in touch, so it was a shock.
Yeah, well, I've got a lot of minor songs, and I don't mean minor key, like the Blackleg Minor and all those wonderful British folk tunes that are, and a lot of which came over to the U.S. as well as American and, I don't want to say it, Appalachian
yeah.
Places that that all the Scottish, Irish, UK songs came over.
Yeah.
And nestled in that part of the world. So Barbara Allen becomes Barbary Allen and all that. And, so there's a lot of, and I love that music, so I'm...
I do too. It's it's wonderful.
Yeah. So I'm familiar with a lot of these places through a lot of these songs and all that. Would you like to take phone calls?
Oh, sure. Did somebody call?
Well, if we ask them to, I'm sure they will.
Okay.
All we have to do is say, if you'd like to call up and speak with Gay Partington Terry or Gay Terry, both are here, at area code 212-209-2900. And Gay, Howard, for that matter, if you want to hear these calls, you're going to need headphones. And I've got to reach all the way over there. And then all I've got to do is say, good morning, you're on the radio.
Hello,
you're on the air.
Yes, can I have the hot beef injection?
I have no idea what that is all about. Hi there, you're on the radio. Hi, turn down your radio, please. The 7-second delay throws people off. Hello? And no, we lost that. And as because of the 7-second delay. Hi, you're on the air.
Good morning, James.
Good morning, Robert.
Gay Terry Park. Gay Partington Terry.
Partington. No K.
Oh, I'm sorry, say it again.
You have Partington's disease. It's Partington.
Partington. I apologize. It is
P-A-R-T. Partington.
Two things. I once met Gay, if I may call you that, a 9th century North Carolinian ballad singer. Her family had been...
She must be really old, but I'm...
No. Her name is Sheila K. Adams from Western North Carolina, Madison County. In fact, she's from Sodom, which doesn't exist anymore. She was once asked whether...
She's really old.
Yeah, really.
No. She was once asked whether there was a Gomorrah. And she said, well, if there was, it was where Jesse Helm would have lived. And it got a big laugh at Symphony Space. But in any case...
I think she was ready for that one.
I once asked her whether, how do you pronounce it? And the great writer Manly Wade Wellman once said to me, it is pronounced Appalachian as if you say, I threw an apple at you. And, you know, that's what they'll tell you one way or t'other, so I take his word. The Isle of Man, absolutely fascinating place. You know, it has its own flag, Terry.
Yes, I know.
It is recognized by the Celtic League American branch as one of the 6, well, we now say 7, Celtic cultures. It, along with Irish and Scots, is one of the 2 linguistic branches of the Celtic family, Breton, Welsh, and Cornish being the other. I actually have in my music collection...
I should explain to Gay that we're talking to a CUNY professor here. So.
Oh.
Yes. Okay. Well, yes. And I actually have...
God help us all.
In my collection, I actually have an entire recording of songs in Manx. Now, there is a Manx language. Very few people actually speak it. There was a young boy who was being researched by a late member of the English Folk Dance and Song Society, Pat Shaw, and he was collecting street rhymes and jump rope games and riddles in Manx, but there are very few people on the Isle of Man, actually, who still speak it as a living language. A few. Let me ask you, have you ever been to the Isle of Man?
Yes, I have. I was there once. Yeah.
Very interesting place in summer. Not very interesting place in winter.
Yeah. Do you have the Hills of Ellen Vannon?
I'm sorry?
Do you have the song The Hills of Ellen Vannon?
In Manx.
Oh, my grandmother used to sing
in
that to
Manx.
Me.
There's a woman, let me see if I remember her name. I think it was something like Anne Christian. And she recorded a CD in Manx, a cappella.
Wow.
And I don't know, Jim has played a lot of great stuff. One of the reasons that BAI is fantastic is because he, of the few people on BAI who are interested in folky stuff like myself, he plays Celtic music. I don't know whether he's actually played material in Manx. I can't say for sure, but if anybody has, he has.
Well, Ed Haber may have beaten me to it because...
You know, it's funny. I should ask him someday, assuming he's still with us. I hope he is. Because he had a great show on BAI called Piper in the Meadow String.
Well, given that he's the head of live productions for New York Public Radio, I suspect he's still with us, yes.
So let me ask you, Gay, is your... unfortunately, I came late to this show. I didn't realize it was Wednesday night, Thursday morning. The story that you read, is it based in Manx lore?
No. Just based on my fantasies.
So maybe someday you will perhaps do some research and write either a novel or a short story. That would be fascinating because I'll tell you, there's lots of stuff in literature, fantasy literature on Scottish and Irish, some even on Welsh.
There's a lot of strange creatures in the Isle of Man.
There are. Yeah, and someday I hope I can... Actually, there is a book.
Well, I would suggest that other writers who are just starting on their journey maybe go and use that for a... For a place. As it is right now, I like discovering the country that is Gay Terry's head.
Well, that's fantastic. I mean, you take authors, for example, like Evangeline Walton, of course, who used Welsh traditional material for her novels. You take even, for example, Charles DeLint, of course, did several novels based in Cornwall.
Yeah.
But I'm trying to really think, and I cannot...
I'm finally going to meet him at World Fantasy this year. I've never met him.
Fascinating fellow, both as a musician and a writer.
Mm-hmm.
And I cannot think, actually, of... Now, this is not to say there hasn't been, but I can't think of anyone who's actually done... Although, just one thing about Manx, you know that perhaps the most famous legend about Manx has to do with cats.
Yeah.
Why Manx cats have no tails, which is a story that actually comes out of the whole Noah's Ark business. You see, the Manx cat did have a tail at one time, but it was the last creature to get on board. The weather was really getting bad. And
they
Noah
shut the door.
He shut the door, and away he went.
Ouch.
But Manx lore, Gay, is absolutely wonderful. But if you look for the name Anne Christian,
okay,
she actually did, as I say, an entire CD of songs in Manx, some of which are like lullabies, some of which are love songs, and some of them are very, very sad memories. You see, a lot of Manx men went to sea and died, and so there are a lot of crooning, it was a lot of songs, women singing songs of bad memories of their lovers or husbands dying at sea. And there are entire traditions. For example, certain birds on the Isle of Man are never shot. And that's the reason for that is that they could be the souls of drowned sailors.
Oh.
And besides, they're not good eating. Otherwise, I'm against the shooting of birds. I like birding.
Oh, you do? Oh, okay.
Yes, I do.
Okay. Anyway, Gay, I'm glad that you... I wish I could have heard your story. But
well, you know, it's
you
in
the
archive. You can buy the book, and it's in the archive, so let's not waste time talking about it.
All right. Well, anyway, continue good luck.
Thank you.
Bye. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thanks for calling.
And if you're currently listening and have missed listening to what you're currently listening to, you can always parse that one out. You can always go to archive.wbai.org, and it will be there for the next few weeks at the very least. And I'm actually finally working on, you know, putting together the podcast that will be the Hour of the Wolf podcast, and then things will be around longer than 2 weeks. Not the music, alas, because that has a lot of rights issues and stuff. But I think that you gave us a wonderful sample.
Oh, good.
Of this strange territory. So,
can I just tell you one of my next ventures is
please, yeah.
I'm going to be reading at the Lounge at Hudson View Gardens on October 14th with David Surface.
Ooh, okay.
And it's a wonderful salon kind of reading that Patricia Eakins runs. And they charge her to a couple of dollars, but there's food and there's wine, and it's really nice, and entertainment.
Now, say this again. This is the Hudson...
The Lounge at Hudson View Gardens. It's on 183rd Street, Washington Heights.
I have only recently heard of Hudson View Gardens.
It's and beautiful.
It sounds... Yeah, it sounds amazing. There's an obscure, wonderful TV show called Secrets of New York that show these different vistas, different secrets of New York. And I think that they did a thing on the gardens there. And that sounds like a fabulous place.
Come and see me. I'll read another story for you if you
want. Yeah, absolutely. Well, let me know. I'll come and record it.
Okay.
So we'll do that. This is something I was talking to our new program director about. We need to record lots and lots and lots of stories.
Okay, sounds good to me.
And hopefully we will continue presenting them on this program. He seemed to like me, so I don't think I'm going away quite just yet. And you're going to have to come back and read more for us.
Oh, great. Sure.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll do that at some time, because I love the undefinable.
Good.
And you're right, there really is no easy way of describing what that is, because it's not magical realism. It is fantasy, but it's certainly not high fantasy or classic fantasy in the Tolkien-esque elvish sense of fantasy, nor is it quite John Collier.
Oh.
Yeah, you know, it's very much its own voice and own thing.
Thank you.
Thank you. And again, to let people know, the name of the book is Meeting the Dog Girls. If your preferred bookstore or online retailer doesn't have it, make them carry it. One always has to say that when it's an independent press, like Nonstop Presses, and they're a quality New York press run by Luis Ortiz, who's also been affiliated, as mentioned earlier, with other people in your writers group.
Yeah.
So that's well worth checking out. So I'm trying to think, what else is there that we need to tell people? I mean, because October is so far off.
Yeah. I don't know what I'm going to be. Well, in between then, actually, my daughter is having a baby in Chicago.
So oh, okay.
Back so and forth to Chicago or the summer and maybe the fall.
You should get in touch with somebody in Chicago and do a reading there.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, you should definitely talk to William Shun, to Bill Shun. I will, S-H-U-N-N, I will give you the particulars of Mr. Shun's dossier. He's a wonderful writer. You'd probably enjoy his stuff. And he has a reading series there that's well worth checking out. God knows what's going on with mine at the moment. I'm trying to figure it all out now. That's why we're taking a vacation. So again, thank you so much for being here.
Well, thanks for having me.
Yeah.
It was fun.
Anything
I can do in my pajamas is good.
Yes. Yeah. Well. Yeah. Those people watching their radios are aware of all that. And thank you, Howard, for the music. And stay tuned, everybody, for Burn Baby Burn Clappers, starring Lister. I mean, that's just, you know, another one of those dull, mundane names for a dull, mundane radio show. Yeah, look at him. Again, watch your radios. I'll be back next week, July 4th, with another episode of Hour of the Wolf. What that will entail, I don't know, but maybe independence, maybe not. Tune in, find out. Again, thank you, Gay Terry.
Thank you.
And thank you all for listening. We'll see you next week.
To wake up to the lies, the pigs make up imperialistic swines that I grind into bacon bits. trans. Cause I'm too black, too strong, too red, too dread. And I'm dreaded cause I make the pigs tremble when I burn a cymbal. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy, I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy. So just hand me a flag from the fastest and watch me burn that piece up to ashes. Cause the real meaning is what the masses must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn. Let's find the people who hate this. These are the places we'll hit.
Number one, Panama, talking about Peru, Azania, Brixton, Belfast, and forget Korea, Beirut, and forget Haiti, Iran, Puerto Rico, Colombia, Mexico. Talk about Uptown, Harlem, New York City, y'all. And Nicaragua, East and South Central LA, California, IA, Miami. Do or die, Bed-Stuy. Never ran, never will, Brownsville. Boogie down, South Bronx, yeah.
My man Joey to jail and now they got him in court because he burned the flag.
Number one.
That's the name of the game. Well, I quit playing. I doubt the suckers want you to hear what I'm saying about this nation. Freedom supposed to be the format, but I step on your flag like it's a floor mat. Maim and mangle the Star Spangled. I'm not trying to diss you. I use the flag like toilet tissue to wipe my black ass. What? You think that I'm a jackass? I see a flag and I attack fast with some fire. My desire to burn what Betty Ross sold up. The truth I show up about America, America, home. Land the free, boom, this is the home of the slave. Now hold on just a mother minute. You gave me freedom of speech in the First Amendment. So why wanna stole me when I torched the flag? I'm only doing what you told me. You don't like it, so what? I'm not scared of you. Your flag, America too. See, I made up this new rule and I want y'all to learn it. Strike a match to the American flag and burn.
Yeah. 5 minutes after 3 o'clock in Twin Toronto Station, WBAI 99.5 FM, New York, WBAI.org, 99.5, as Madeline Knight James would say right here at 99.5, WBAI. 5 o'clock shadow this afternoon, don't miss it because it's going to be happening, Mr. Big Stuff. Only the shadow knows at 5 o'clock. There would be no day without the night, y'all. Yeah.
Teacher, teacher.
Mm-hmm. Lister.
I beg you ring the bell. Teach your children. Teach them how to spell. R-A-T rat. M-A-T mat. C-A-T cat. Look at that, look at that. You got to learn that. Yeah! You got to graduate. Teacher, teacher, I beg you ring the bell.
99 Cinco for Robert Knight and Madeline Knight. G Knight right here at 99 Cinco WBAI, your favorite radio station. Here we go. Yeah. Madeline Knight, we'll never forget you right here at 99 Cinco, y'all. 10 minutes after 3 o'clock. Love, boom.
the doctor with a bitch in all the bill.